Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Is it rolling?
Okay, let's go.
Hello and welcome to the Rock On Tours podcast. I am Gary Kemp.
And I'm Guy Pratt. They said it wouldn't happen, but here we are, where each week we bribe a friend of ours for an hour of their time to chew the cud on life of the fast lane of music.
Yeah, we've been mates for a long time, haven't we? Are we now playing a band together?
We do play in a band together.
Nick Mason's also full of secrets. And this episode, we are speaking to one of the finest pop producers in the world. Three Brit Awards, a Grammy Award winner, Ivor Novello Award, blah, blah, blah.
And a man whose production skills and musical influence earned him the title The Man Who Invented the 80s.
I thought that was me. No. Trevor Horn.
Trevor.
Hey. How are you, Trevor?
I'm fine. It's nice to be here.
We go back quite a long way. I think you saved my arse back in 1982 when you remixed Instinction.
Instinction, yeah. Well, I always liked your band. I really liked Muscle Bound, and which was yours is the one that had the syndrums on the Lindra,
chant number one.
The really liked that.
Kit, yeah.
Yeah, first Simmons kit record. I really liked that. I liked the production on it too.
And I remember we had a difficult second album, and the third single had not done as well as any of us had hoped. And but we knew there was something here. There was gold to be mined, and that was the next album. and Trevor kindly said, "Look, I wouldn't want to remix this. I'd like to mostly re-record it," which we did with Ann Dudley, didn't we?
Yeah, we gave it the treatment. It was really funny because I don't know if I ever told you. I probably told you this one where
don't go break my heart.
Where the guys in ABC were very competitive, and when I said that I was going to remix a track from your album, they were really pissed off at me, right? Because we were working on the album Lexicon of Love, and a few days we did it in a couple of days, and it came out really well, Instinction. So it was done, and I was back working with them, and JJ, the Fairlight programmer, came up with a sort of heavy guitar for one little section of one of the songs, and he played it on there. And I always remember Mark came in, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and said, "What's that guitar?" And I said, "Oh, Gary Kemp was by." And I said, "Hey, Gary, have a jam on the track." And Mark went crazy. He believed me for about 45. "You did that. You let him come in here on track," and the whole bit. And I was it's a wind up. It's dumbass.
But how did you come across ABC? Because that was your kind of jump, wasn't it, into sort of...
Well, it was. I suppose Dollar was...
Well, it was very much pop, wasn't it? Although Buggles were.
Buggles were definitely pop.
Go on, let's go back.
And the great thing about pop is I would argue that it's the least conservative of all the musical forms, because it evolves with whatever's going on, whereas you tend to have all of the other musical forms sort of get set in aspic and fall away. I mean, let's face it, jazz, you know every kind of jazz now. It's in a museum. But pop evolves because it's like a hamburger, you know, it develops all the time, different ingredients.
Obviously, you created a lot of sounds that people have impersonated over the years. But at the same time now, you have to be aware of what people are doing, what is popular, what makes pop music now. And I mean, I listen to Capital Radio with my kids, and there's not a singer who hasn't got auto-tuned wound to the hilt, you know, and there's no guitars on there. So is that something you think making records now I have to sort of be guided by?
I was never really guided by anything much other than what I fancied doing. I'm not in a position where I have to try and make something that I don't understand. Yeah. Although I often feel like I don't really understand. But, I just had this big album with Rod Stewart, but it was putting an orchestra on a bunch of old masters.
Yeah. Went to number one.
That's the kind of thing old guys like me get to do now. It's much more like that rather than a young sort of pop-tastic person who they don't come to old guys anymore.
Well, I mean, for example, I was amazed when I... Because how your reputation preceded you before I knew you was as very much the professor and of this kind of working in this very much laboratory environment of the studio. And what really surprised me is how you're actually way more of a band guy than anyone perceived you to be. What you actually really liked was musicians in a room playing.
Yes, absolutely.
And which is absolutely not how
how
because you're a great musician, a great player.
Well, I earned my living playing bass till I was 30. I mean, that's how I paid the rent. But I always remember in my mid 20s when I was playing in a nightclub 7 nights a week. You know, no nights off.
What club?
It was Bailey's Club in Leicester, and 7 nights a week. Funny story: I played 7 nights a week for a year, and I had a week off. Right, what do I do on the first night? I go down to the club. Because Harry Secombe's on.
Oh, wow.
And all my mates are going to be there, right? So I get down to the club. This is Sunday night. And the manager sees me, comes running over. Thank God you're here. I'm off. It's my holiday. he said the busman's holiday. The guy in the replacement band can't read. And Harry Secombe's stuff's all written out. So can you do Harry Secombe? So sure. So I got up and borrowed the guy's bass and played behind Harry Secombe, which was great because I'm a huge Goons fan. And then I gave my father the gig for the rest of the week because my dad was a bass player and he showed up and played behind Harry Secombe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow. So your father was a bass player and you can read music. So you told us that much. How did that all begin for you?
Yeah, well, my dad played double bass in a local dance band, but he was an engineer. He was what they used to call back in the day semi-pro. That's how I came to play the bass guitar because I'll never forget, he showed me Way Down Upon the Swanee River on the double bass in G. Boom, 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 boom. Way down upon the Swanee. And he said, then he goes to a C. Boo, boo. Ah, I figured it out, you know. I worked it all out for myself, really, from playing the recorder. I didn't have any lessons, but I could read for the recorder. And if you think about it, bass parts were pretty simple. Two crotchets in a bar with a crotchet rest in between. And by the middle of the song, it would probably pep up and you'd start to play four. Boom, boom, you start to walk it. And then it would go back down to two again.
Yeah.
So there's nothing complicated to read. And if you can read for the recorder, you can do that. So that's kind of how I sort of started doing it. And then one night my dad came home with a bass guitar and said, this is going to change the world, because now they know if you're playing the right note or not. My dad had
because it had frets,
and my dad would get really cross with the other bass players in town because some of them, he said, they're just bluffers. They haven't got a bloody clue what they're playing. This is up in Durham, you know. They move their hand and they pretend and they make a thump, but they don't know what key they're
playing. Famous for its bluffing bass players.
Exactly.
No, but I always found that, if you listen to, like, and some of the great jazz bass players, and I always think, it's in our world of sort of fretless basses and everything, there's no way we could get away with the sort of tuning that they're allowed to get away with.
No, you couldn't possibly.
So where did you go to form your own band? And who was your heroes?
No. What happened was, so I used to just, when I was about 12 or 13, my dad used to let me play the first set on a Saturday night when nobody was in. And so that was my sort of, that was where I first started doing it. And then he showed me the bass guitar. I used to spend every evening in a room trying to teach myself how to play the guitar. I wanted to start the Beatles. And I did eventually have a group called the Outer Limits that I was the lead guitar player in, on an acoustic guitar, with a pickup on it. And we played kink songs and stuff like that. The bass guitar was just something that I did every now and again to sit in for my dad or something like that. Then I was a Bob Dylan impersonator. I could still do it. I can still remember nearly all the verses of Desolation Row.
Oh, come on. And this is still up in Durham, is it?
By this point I'd moved to Leicester, and I was doing the harmonicas, come gather round people wherever you roam, all the verses of Mr. Tambourine.
Oh, it's like he's in the room.
Actually, this that's a good point, because now you showed us that you could do impersonating singers. You ended up doing that for a living for a bit, didn't you?
John Anderson.
No, I didn't mean that. No, I meant on those KTEL records or whatever they were, on the Top of the Pops records in the 70s.
I mainly did Brian Ferry because they said...
You did Brian Ferry?
You can sing out of tune, so you can do Brian Ferry. come on, let's stick together. We made a vow to leave one another never. That kind of stuff, wasn't it?
So for anyone who doesn't know, these are the records we had them in our house because we couldn't afford to buy all the singles. So you used to make a record every month, maybe, that had the chart
every
hits on, all played exactly like the original records, but with
Yeah.
Session musicians, not the real band.
I first came to London, you know, I played in loads of local mecca bands. What happened is suddenly bass guitar parts became much more complicated, like more or less overnight.
Dance music.
Well, all the mecca ballrooms were starting to have kids in at the weekend. And the record that really kicked all the old double bass, and most of the guys, so your average mecca band, we'd have a horn section, bass, guitar, drums, keyboards, and a couple of singers. And nearly all of the bass players were old double bass players who picked up a bass guitar because it was easier. And this group called Love Affair brought out a record called... Everlasting Love. And it was very fast, a very great bass part. Remember it?
Yeah, but this is great. I never knew this story.
Heart's gone astray, deep and hurt when they go. That one. That was the sort of very fashionable bass sound.
Do you know who played? Who was it? The person in the band, or would have been like one of the Wrecking Crew or someone?
It would have been. I often wondered if it was John Paul Jones.
Oh, it's English.
Yeah, it's English. Yeah.
Well, it's probably John Paul Jones.
Actually, funny enough, now I get relax. I see what you know. This emphasis on that driving bass.
So I could play it because I learnt it. You know, I was playing semi-pro in a band called the Eric Upton Band. I was about 17, and we were playing four nights a week, and it was you know like had a small horn section, functions, you know, the kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we played everything from waltzes to the late. I used to sing like things like Daydream Believer, White as Shade of Pale, and whatever. Hey Jude.
And had you left school and you were...
Yes, I had left school, yeah, because I was 17, man. I really neglected all of my studies trying to play the guitar. You know what I mean? I'm sure you all did.
Yeah, you're same. Yeah, yeah.
And screwed up totally.
Exactly.
And then, you know, when I was meant to do classes, never went. But, you know, I was working at the John Bull Rubber Company. I mean, you want to know how fluky things can get. The guy sitting behind, I was working in the costing office, trying to cost out how you, a little rubber hose that goes between the radiator and the engine, right? I had a slide rule. I was useless at it. And so I had figured out a whole set of ploys where I did basically nothing, you know? You know that line of Prince's? There was I busy doing nothing but different from the day before.
Oh.
Yeah, I was an expert at doing that.
Looking busy.
And the guy behind me said, I met a guy in the pub last night and he's the band leader at the Top Rank. His name's Johnny Wollaston. And I told him about you and he's interested. He wants to meet you. I was like, really? Yeah, I said, you know, you were 17 and a half. You played in a semi-pro band and everything. So anyway, sure enough, I go to meet this Johnny Wollaston. He says to me, can you play Everlasting Love? First thing he said to me, right? I said, yeah, I can play Everlasting Love. He said, right, come and see my band.
It's the benchmark.
So yeah. I went and watched a set with his band, and I could see at some point in the set they played Everlasting Love, and I could see the guy. The guy was trying to play it with his fingers, and you could probably play it with your fingers, but you'd be struggling, man, because, you know what I mean, it's so fast.
The slap of a gauntlet going down right there.
We'll get the bass out. We'll try, right? And at the end, so then at the end of watching that, he said to me, well, do you think you could play with my band? And I said, yeah. He said, well, leave me your number, I'll bear you in mind. Cut to like 6 months later, and I've just been fired from my latest job, which was Progress Chaser at a plastic bag factory. Because I'd woken my parents up at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, I've got this all figured out. I'm going to go into the music business.
That's great.
I'm going to do it like now because it's hopeless. Anything else is just going to be hopeless.
And they went, but it's 4 in the morning.
It's 4 in the morning.
Yeah. And once more, the dawn.
Exactly. They said, get one more job. I had this terrible job. They fired me. And my dad said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to turn pro. And he said, how are you going to do that? And I said, I'm going to look in the Melody Maker. He said, but you're not good enough. I've been fired from my job, so I can practice. Anyway, I got up the next morning, and I was just getting ready to go out for the Melody Maker, and there's a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and it was Johnny Wollaston. It was an extraordinary coincidence. And he came and says, thank God you're here. He came in. He said, I've got a contract. Would you start with my band in 3 weeks' time? I was like, yeah. Wow. He said, it's £24 a week for 5 nights. You OK with that? And I was... Are you kidding? I've been getting 10 quid a week for a 40-hour week. So I signed the contract. I said, don't you want to hear me play? And he said, no, you'll be fine, I'm sure. And I said, but can I come in and look at all through the parts for the next few days? He said, yeah, I'll sort it out with the manager. So for the next 3 weeks, I went in every day and spent like 5-7 hours going through all the parts, you know. And then I had my opening night. Of course, I was the kid, you know, I was only 18, and I was like, this is the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. And all the rest of the band were grumpy old geezers who didn't like me. Too fucking loud, straight away, you know. and then hated Johnny Wollaston with a passion, you know.
And you had your own amp and your own kit, or all your own gear?
Yes, I had a Hofner Artist bass guitar.
Oh, right. And a Wem Dominator.
And a Selma 50 with an 18-inch speaker in it. So that was how I started, and I never went back to the normal world.
In the 70s, though, dance music did sort of become more...
Well, no, I'm to...
of a focus for you later.
Where I am now, I'm just at the end of the 60s, man. This is 69, 68, 69 when I started,
And who were your bass heroes at that point?
My bass heroes were probably the guy in The Who, you know, John Entwistle. Yeah, he was the most exciting one I'd ever seen. And we'd supported them once, the Eric Upton band. Read my music off Keith Moon's drums. We were on first while they were eating, and then we played for a little bit of General Dancing, and then The Who came on. It was Leicester University. The Who were amazing. I mean, they were terrific.
What year was that?
Would have been 68, 69.
Oh, okay.
So they were doing Ivor the Engine Driver.
Oh, yeah, Quick One. That's like peak.
Oh, man, yeah. Even the old saxophone players thought they were good.
Wow.
You know?
So
that's
saying. And then what about London? Did that sort of...
I came to London when I was 21. Then I had a kind of... As you do, you know, I got... I took LSD and realised, you know, how terrible what I was doing was. So I decided to turn a new page. And
dad was right.
Went back to John Ball Rubber Company.
It wasn't so much my playing, but who I was playing with and what I was playing.
Right.
I was just playing for money. So I went for an audition. I joined a group called the Canterbury Tales down in... where was it? Margate. And they had
That sounds like an incredible string band.
They were okay. I mean, I had a year with them. I never knew...
What kind of music?
Never knew poverty like it. You know? Because
was it prog?
No, it wasn't prog. We did a sort of cross-section of stuff, you know, from...
Well, it must have had a sort of Merry England vibe.
No, it didn't. We used to... It was mainly covers because nobody wrote. It wasn't original music.
Oh, I see, okay.
You know, join a band playing original music, then that's even deeper poverty.
We have to push ahead into why you ended up forming Buggles and where all that started. Was that your first... record in your name, as it were?
Well, I got interested in studios when I was with Ray McVeigh because we started to do... I was interested in them before, and I did lots of broadcasts before, you know. But with Ray, we were doing lots of things, you know. We do a party album and then, you know, loads of gigs and all kinds of things. And I'd always go in and listen to the playback. I got in trouble a few times for, like, singing along with it and things like that. I decided I could take no more of being on the coach 5 hours... 5 hours back, 2 1.5-hour sets of the cavalcade of crap, as I used to call it. And I just had to get out of it. So I went back to Leicester. I left London, went back to Leicester, started working in this nightclub and built a studio with another guy. During the day, we used to work on the studio. A guy gave us a barn, an old barn, and we did all the work ourselves. He paid for the materials, we did the work. Lay bricks, putting in straw board, all kinds of things. We had our equipment, which I'd bought with all the money I got from Ray McVeigh, was 2 Revoxes, an Alice AD-62 and 4 microphones. One compressor, I think, I had. And
so you literally learnt about studios from the ground up, you know, you put it on the walls.
And so we made...
Yeah, how did you know, what did you, I mean, how did you...
Talk to lots of people, read a couple of books.
How did you decide what a studio was going to be? What books were there?
Well, because I'd worked in them. You could get a book.
Was it Eastlake making studios at that point?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I was crap like...
East Midlands.
It took
Gone Westlake.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
It took nearly a year, and of course, by the time we finished, we got no business. I somehow thought...
What business did you think
I had
there
no
was
idea.
Going to be in Leicester?
I had no idea, but I started...
Come to Leicester!
I started to make a few records, and...
Under what title?
Saw a guy in a talent competition at Lester Bailey's who sang terrible songs about ghastly things that happened that he'd written himself. I decided to call him Daniel Doom, and I recorded him and sent them off, but got rejections. I did a Leicester, this is the season for Leicester record with the Leicester football team. We did that. By that point, we had an engineer.
Does that still exist, that record?
You'll probably be able to find it. This is the big one.
So that was your first production.
Amazing, you
didn't do a remix of that for when they won the league.
Well, the problem was that it was done by a private guy, and he had 5,000 of them printed up because Leicester were doing really well that year, and then the next week they got kicked out.
So who is your inspiration? George Martin?
As a producer, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, some guy, I was getting to the point, some guy said to me, you know what you're doing is called being a record producer.
Right.
I was like, that's what a record producer, I never knew. From that moment, it took me like 5 years of making publishers' demos to, in the end, Video Killed the Radio Star. You know, I had a couple of minor things before it, but...
What were they?
A thing called Monkey Chop with Dan I.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, that's... Wow. I was in a band with him. I lived in the squat that he lived with in Elgin Avenue. My first squat was with Dan I.
Wow.
But how did your relationship come together when you formed Buggles?
Well, Jeff was my keyboard player. He was in the team. You see, for years I was Tina Charles's MD. Whenever Tina Charles, because I'd been a boyfriend. It was a fairly tempestuous relationship, but it was still going at that point. And
I Love to Love, wasn't it?
I Love to Love. Yeah. And I always say, you know, people ask me about that I learned more from listening to the backing track of I Love to Love. So I never heard a backing track done by a hit record producer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was trying to work out how the fuck do you do it, man?
That was like a real disco template, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like a disco template. Yeah. And I thought, he's done it with a drum machine so that they're all perfectly in time.
So what was the drum machine around then?
It was probably had the same thing that we had, Mini Pops Junior. which was like
basically the thing that was in an organ, wasn't it?
It was in a hotel. But just to hear, you know, I was always fighting with drummers. Do you have to put so many kick drums in? Do you have to do that? Can't you do whatever? Hearing, oh, I love to love, how precise the whole thing was.
And dry.
And dry and kind of cold, but spot on. You know what I mean? I thought, that's how you do it. That's how you got to get it to sound. So from that moment on, unless there was a good reason, I did everything to some kind of a groove. Just made everything more easy. Editing, echo lens.
The drums always come first, the bass and drums.
Absolutely, but I'm sure you had the same sort of feelings. You know, if you think about it, towards the end of the 70s, punk came along. Punk was just horrible. But it kind of blew the door wide open. It meant you could do anything at all. I mean, if people would listen to that crap, you know, you could get away with anything.
Well, but the point...
There was a couple of good records.
Well, yeah, but
that's
not... No, but the whole point of punk, it seems to me, is because it was the 80s were basically born out of punk. Mm-hmm. The point of it was the whole point was just do it yourself. It's like, if you don't like the music that's out there, then start a band. There's no magazine song to you, start a magazine. Yeah.
And I always think the 80s the three defining sort of styles would have been the Sex Pistols meet Chic meets Kraftwerk. You know, there was.
See, it's sort of, but don't forget, if you're a record producer, you're up against Elton John, and Elton John's records sounded amazing because it was a great team of musicians. They really knew what
they
were
doing. I was playing Funeral for a Friend the other day. Yeah, still an
brilliant sounding record. Yeah. Put it on your stereo. Led Zeppelin, you know, the Eagles. Mind you, the Eagles didn't sound that good at the start. But still, you know, you're going to make a record. What the hell are you going to make that's going to be anywhere near as good as that?
You're making it for the world.
You know, so that was.
So
techno was like manna from heaven. It was here is a way. When I heard Man Machine, I thought, wouldn't it be great to kind of do a mainstream record that got on the top 20 but had a mechanical beat behind it?
But that was our influence as well, over at the Blitz Club. You know, Russ Egan's playing Man Machine.
And probably Warm Leatherette.
Warm Leatherette, and I went out and we all clubbed together, and we went from being a post-punk band into a band with a synthesizer. And I took the synth home and wrote all of our first album. It was that exciting, wasn't it? And in monophonic.
Oh, yeah, the monophonic synthesizer, yeah. The only person who really did a good record tracking synths up was Gino Vannelli. Remember Gino Vannelli?
Love
of my life. He was a bit fruity, Gino, but... And they were world jazz rock, brother to brother. Some great drumming on that. I've got to listen to that again, actually.
Well, isn't the story, isn't it, that ABC were a kind of Human League-y, electro-type band, but then there was this legendary gig, apparently Chic played at the Sheffield Odeon.
Yeah.
And everyone, like all the skinheads, went to beat up all the soul boys. And apparently it's become this absolutely legendary gig that it sort of turned the whole... Everyone just fell in love with Chic. And ABC became the band they became.
Yeah.
And,
well, you're quite right.
Because Human League came out of Sheffield as well, didn't they?
ABC used to they told me in the band that they were in before ABC, they carried the gear around in a carrier bag. That they were quite weird. I mean, I didn't know what to make of them anyway. I didn't know why they
How did they come to you?
Well, it was my late wife saw them. They just had a hit with The Tears of Not Enough. Tears Are Not Enough. And she said, I've found the perfect band for you because they're really good writers and they're bright, but they need somebody to make the records better. And I think I was one of quite a few people they saw. But, you know,
You'd already done Dollar, hadn't you?
I'd done Dollar. I'd been in Yes.
Which
as
I thought Dollar. Dollar was, I mean, for me, that was that's still one of the great pop records, intelligent pop records. The production stood out for me.
Well, it was all very analog. If you listen to the start of Mirror Mirror, it sort of goes blip, 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 blip. And then there's the sound of a bottle smashing and everyone, hey! And I mean, I had to literally smash the bottle.
Your idea,
though? Bottles, with a couple of spanners on a tarpaulin in the studio with mics above it. You know, Gary Lang had recorded it.
Because you see music, you hear music very visually, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And this was a perfect act for you because they weren't, you know, writing their own stuff. They weren't,
They just said to me, you make a Buggles record and we'll sing it. So I tried to think about their world because I normally write the lyrics and we came up with sort of four songs, their little world, them falling in love, them being in love, them falling out and them seeing each other. You know, that was what it was like.
But I think there was also this feeling of responsibility that
with the new decade starting, and this was 1980s, you know, and we were, yeah. And you're at the beginning, and you've got to make the sound like the future, haven't you? You've got to do something that doesn't sound like the 70s. That's part of the inspiration, isn't it?
Yeah, but by that point, I was a bit more confident, you know. I'd done a Yes album as well, Drama, and so I really knew how to work 48 track analog, you know.
So what became your guiding principles in production? Did you have a kind of like, oh, I think I've discovered I'm doing something that no one else is doing? And
well, I discovered at a certain point that it was pointless trying to imitate other people. It always came out wrong. And it came, whatever I did, it sounded a certain way. So I thought maybe I'll just exaggerate that. I'll exaggerate it more, you know, like I'll just...
I'd, like the drum,
yeah, just coming out. You know, exaggerate this idea of picking things, you know, like on, you know, Video Killed the Radio Star. There's no programming or anything, but you know, just the way that we use the voices, the our O's and everything. That was from years of being in the studio. I mean, I don't know about you, but I, when I first ever engineered, I discovered that real stereo is bollocks, right? If you put something left, hard left, and different thing, hard right, that's much more interesting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Any kind of stereo. These days, I mean, it drives me nuts. Every bloody keyboard overdub is meant to be in stereo. I mean, why?
Did you ever get a band, did you ever get a band saying to you, we can never do this live?
Yes.
Because that's listening
no
to
there.
If you listen to your records, Trevor, and that's partly the beauty of them, that it sounds like nothing that can be reproduced live, and yeah, you're getting a different experience.
Yeah, we play them live. You can play them live. They work well. It just depends which ones, you know. The Frankie ones, you have to use a bit of track, but we don't. We play two tribes. We don't play it with any track. You know, so.
But when you're inventing it in the studio, it's the studio as an instrument, isn't
it? Oh, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, they started using the studio as an instrument, the Beatles, yeah. You know, George Sergeant Martin, Peppers. That whole bit, you know, yeah. Once they got their heads in there. I've been actually reading a lot about the Beatles lately, and it's, you know, something I never thought about, but loads of the times when they did their lead vocals, they slowed the tape down so that they came back, you know, semitone up. To make their voices sound more youthful, because a couple of times I thought, what they were doing
here, there,
there,
and everywhere is has that. I know
really?
that one's tuned up higher.
But also, it's quite surprising in some way, like how technologically basic it was. But then also, there's stuff that's quite technologically advanced, which I always find quite surprising about the Beatles stuff. You know,
yeah.
Like I always thought that putting a piano through a Leslie, putting anything else through a Leslie, was invented on Echoes. There's a story that it was Floyd insisted on them taking it apart. But then I just heard the White Album demos, and they've got everything going through the Leslie on that.
Yeah,
so they already had a thing of putting everything, vocals and everything, through the Leslie.
For instance. Absolutely.
And they had voltage control things where they could sync tapes and stuff in there.
But you started to make a point a while back. Is when you said that I'm a sort of a band guy.
Yeah.
My favourite way of doing stuff is always to use a group of players, because, you know, a lot of the time you're dealing with the same few chords, you know? You know, A to F sharp minor to D or whatever.
Write this down!
But you know what I mean? And some people, and you need people who can take those three chords and make them sound interesting.
Yeah.
And that's a gift. Some people can play well and they're good, but some people can just do interesting things that you need.
I worked with you so, 5 years ago on a few tracks, and I know you like to put the band down almost as it is in rehearsals first. Mm. I think what was impressive about working with you was you could take those tapes home, hard drives home, and sit and chop them up. And think, well, we don't have to start this way. Maybe I could take a bit of this middle eight here, and I can start with that. Yeah. And that's and probably the most exciting part for you, isn't it? Restructuring the song, and also the most important part.
If it needs it. Right. Sometimes it does. Depends.
What are you saying, Trevor?
Well, quite often writers, you know, the writers don't, you know, they like one bit better than another, and it's not necessarily the best bit.
Yeah.
But it's always that thing of trying to make it into a coherent form. That's record production. I always think that's, in a way, that's one
a series of events.
One of the most important parts of it, you know, just editing the song into a good shape so that it's satisfying.
I still love one of my favourite things in the world to listen to. Still, and never ever gets old, is the version of Slave to the Rhythm where it's just the whole backing track and then the whole song.
Yeah.
Oh, right. For some reason, and to me, it doesn't seem complete until I've heard...
I mean, for me, I mean, that's still one of my favourite things you've ever done, Slave to the Rhythm. And yet it was probably one of the hardest things for you to give birth to, wasn't it?
Well, no, I was just a bit out on a limb because they only wanted a single. And and I did it once, and I didn't like it very much because it was like a marching band.
But you must have known the song had something.
It was. I liked the title. But it was originally, "Work all day as men who know." And Grace actually originally sang it like that, but I didn't like it. I just, you know, I thought, this is going to go on an album with Sly and Robbie. I can't possibly put this on there. Right. This is just so... And I don't think it'll fit. We need to find a way of doing. And I ended up using a go-go rhythm. And when I played... When Bruce heard the go-go rhythm, he came up with those chords. And we just rewrote the song around it. But, you know, the whole track's made up of one little one-minute thing that they played when they were warming up.
Because there's really? All sorts of great apocryphal tales about your record, and I'm sure I've probably asked you this before, and you've probably said no, but because there was one story that went around for years, which is that the hi-hat on that record is actually J.J. Bell, the guitarist, just going...
Now, the hi-hat on one of the tracks is Louis Jardine doing that.
Oh, OK, doing that, is it really?
Yeah, we were thinking of...
He's one of the great percussionists.
Yeah, we would think, we need a hi-hat, but oh, it sounds so duff. I said, why don't you sing it, Lou? See what it sounds like. I do it, Trevor. No problem.
And I guess what made that such a great record in the end is you had the money and the time to keep it going.
I never thought about the money.
It's not like a week of you've got to have this record out.
No, I got carried away and I started doing other versions of it and whatever, you know. Even got Dave to play on it.
That's right, yeah. Gilmore. He's not on the record, is he? Yeah,
he is.
Is it the metal version?
He's on the fashion show, which is the sort of very programmed sort of version of the record. It has sort of talking on it and it builds up into a guitar thing. Yeah, I'll point it out to you.
If you had to pick one record to be remembered by that you did in that period, what would it be?
I don't know. The sort of proud moments. I don't know. I never felt like that. I was always too paranoid about the next one.
Too hungry. Because after the 80s finished, you met Seal and you ended up making those incredible records with him.
I think that... And they were kind of quite different to Frankie. The whole ethic was different.
Yeah.
I suppose if I have to listen to anything of my own, I tend to go back and listen to Seal, you know?
Yeah.
First two albums and the fourth album I'm particularly fond of, you know.
How did he come to you?
Jill said she wanted a modern-day Nat King Cole. Then Jill got very enthusiastic. She played me Crazy, his demo of it, but I didn't think much of it because he put his voice through a phaser. And she was saying, he's got a terrific voice. And I was like, oh, he's through a phaser. I can't tell. You know what I mean? And she said, you've got to meet him. I got a shock when I met him because he was wearing Cuban heel boots. He's 6'7", 6'8". But, you know, it's one of those things. You meet somebody, like, within... And you wonder what they're going to be like. And within sort of 5 minutes, I had a total musical hard-on for him. I couldn't wait to get him in front of a microphone.
Do you know what I think? I remember actually being at Hook End and you playing me some stuff. I can't remember but it was from that album. But what I thought immediately was, because when you make a production, everything has got its space in the EQ world. There doesn't seem to be things overlapping in the same tones. And his voice, he just has this beautiful, high sort of sound tone that cuts through, and you can fill around it, can't you? It doesn't suck up all the space.
Well, it was a funny moment on Crazy, because we went mad doing Crazy. We were so paranoid, because we were following the killer, you know? Number one. No pressure, you know? Fucking pressure.
But he hadn't even been credited on that, had he?
No, he wasn't even credited on that.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, they were stupid. They said, sign this contract where you take your voice off the record. And he said, take my voice off the record. Not signing any contract.
So who did it come out
of? He signed with us instead. Because Jill got him. She spent ages getting him. And then I had to coax him into the studio because he part of the deal was he was working with Guy Sigsworth. But they'd spent 6 weeks and they were getting nowhere. It wasn't an easy record to make. But by the time I got it... I remember when we were mixing it, Jill came into the mix. I said, what do you think? She said, he's not loud enough. Seal's not loud enough. I didn't pay all this money not to hear him. So, okay, push him up. Is this loud enough? No, louder. Push him up. She said, that sounds right. And I remember the engineer jumped up and, you know, did that kind of a thing.
And I said, worried about the track getting
smaller. I said, OK, darling, let me deal with it. And we just did that old trick where, you know, we put it through a, like, American radio limiter where every time Seal sung, the track got backed off enormously.
Oh, really?
And then the minute you stopped, the track came right back up again. Really exaggerated. I've done it loads of times. It does work. I mean,
you put the whole track through the limiter at the end.
Yeah, well, two sets of limiters. We had it through an SSL limiter and then over the top of it, because every time Seal's... I think we had the track through a limiter. Seal not through... Obviously, had probably a tube tech on him, because there was no EQ on Seal. No EQ button.
Wow.
Keep off the EQ.
That's all his that lovely resonance. Yeah.
And it sort of worked, you know. You can hear it on the record, plain as day. And with Seal, you know, the basic trick was that when he's down low, have him drying in your face, and when he goes up high, put him back with a little bit of reverb on him. It works.
Bit of spin or something.
Yeah, well, whatever.
Trevor, thank you. I think we might have to
we're out of time.
Yeah.
Wrap
Damn.
Up. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, well, good.
Thanks for this.
Touched on a few things.
Especially the early days. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yes, the early days.
So that's it for the episode of Rock on Tours today with Trevor Horn. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can send an email to guyandgary@podcastworks.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.